Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author, who takes a critical look at Trump's reckless Gaza plan to ethnically cleanse 2.3 million Palestinians from their homes and widespread rejection of the proposal. Amanda Marcotte, senior political writer with Salon.com, who discusses Elon Musk's illegal demolition of federal government agencies and the white supremacy that permeates his fascist child army. And Praisley McNamara, an organizer of the February 5th, 5051 anti-Trump protest in Hartford, Connecticut, who talks about her motivation to take a lead role in mobilizing her neighbors to protect democracy from the Trump-Musk coup. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
German conservative leader Friedrich Merz, who leads the Christian Democratic Union and Christian Social Union Alliance, failed in an attempt to pass legislation that would tighten border security and impose new restrictions on asylum seekers just weeks before the nation's February 23rd federal election. Merz's alliance with a far-right Alternative for Germany party, or AfD, linked with neo-Nazis, fueled outrage and massive protests. Germany's former Conservative Party Chancellor, Angela Merkel, condemned the alliance with the AfD, as did Holocaust survivors, faith leaders, journalists, and opposition politicians. Tightening restrictions on immigrants in Germany gained traction after a series of violent migrant attacks. The proposed bill stirred intense debate, but in the end lost by 11 votes, embarrassing Merz, who, if he wins the election, could be the first German chancellor to break the country's so-called firewall against allowing extremist right-wing parties into a governing coalition. Merz's actions could derail his party's predicted win in the upcoming election by changing the debate from Germany's faltering economy and immigration to concern about the mainstreaming of the far-right AfD party, a potential boost to both Merz's mainstream opponents and the AfD itself, which is in second place in national polls. New Zealand's political leaders gathered at the Waitangi Treaty Grounds in the country's far north on February 5th to celebrate the 1840 signing of the Treaty of Waitangi, considered New Zealand's founding document and instrumental in upholding the Maori people's indigenous rights. But at the event, hundreds of Maori protesters walked out of the ceremony, and indigenous leaders turned their backs on Conservative Party officials, who have faced a year of protest for their attempt to weaken Maori rights, including a major rollback of policies designed to improve Maori health and well-being. Few policies have angered the Maori as much as the right-wing ACT Party's Treaty Principles Bill, which proposes to radically alter the way the historic Waitangi Treaty is interpreted. Although the bill is unlikely to become law, its introduction has prompted anger from many who believe it is creating division and undermining the cherished treaty. Days before the Super Bowl game was played in New Orleans, nurses at the city's University Medical Center called a two-day strike in an effort to win their first contract. The strike, organized by National Nurses United, which represents more than 600 nurses at the hospital, has expressed concern over what they describe as management's union-busting stall tactics and an unwillingness to make progress in contract talks. Priority issues for the nurses include the need to improve staff preparedness during mass casualty events that was experienced during the New Year's truck attack on Bourbon Street that killed 14 people and injured dozens more. The nurses are also calling for protections against the rapid introduction of artificial intelligence. The nurses see their strike as part of a fight for their patients and a New Orleans that cares for everyone. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
During a joint news conference with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on February 5th, President Donald Trump proposed a plan for the U.S. to seize control of Gaza and forcibly remove 2.3 million Palestinians from their homes, as he bragged that he'd rebuild the war-devastated territory as a new Middle East Riviera. Trump's plan, which called on both Egypt and Jordan to take in Gaza's entire Palestinian population, was immediately rejected and condemned as ethnic cleansing by Arab governments, world leaders, and human rights groups. Trump's Gaza plan, characterized as horrifying and ridiculous by some U.S. lawmakers, was proposed as the Hamas-Israel-Gaza ceasefire agreement was in danger of collapse after Hamas accused Israel of violating the three-week ceasefire, endangering the scheduled release of Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners. Just prior to a February 11th White House meeting with Jordan's King Abdullah, where Trump doubled down on his Gaza plan, he threatened to withhold billions of dollars in U.S. aid to Jordan and Egypt unless the two nations agreed to take in all of Gaza's Palestinian residents. Your reporter spoke with Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, international advisor for Jewish Voice for Peace, and author. Here she takes a critical look at Trump's reckless Gaza plan and the virtually unanimous international denunciation of this criminal proposal.
This is a plan that is rooted in an acknowledged combination of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Ethnic cleansing is a crime. The deliberate expulsion of a population from a particular group is a crime against humanity. That doesn't seem to have any relevance to Trump and his people. What's clear is that he sees, I would say, the world at the moment, but certainly at the moment he's seeing Gaza from the eyes of a real estate agent. Now, he's not the first. Just a couple of years ago, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, looked at the territory around Gaza and said, "Whoa, we could do something with this. This is beautiful seaside country." His special envoy, who is also historically a real estate broker, looked at it a couple of weeks ago and said, "I don't know if I should say this, but all I see is 25 miles of prime sunset-facing beachfront." Those are the words of somebody who's an expert in knowing what sells, right? It's not enough to be on a beach. You have to be on a beach that faces the sunset. And that's what he knew. So this is the vantage point of the Trump administration, is personal aggrandizement, personal enrichment, personal power. It's not even a situation where Trump is reflecting some kind of accountability to one of the various factions of imperial rule in this country. You know, it's not like everybody agrees. There's sort of isolationists and sort of interventionists in various forms. But this isn't even about that. This is about personal claim. I am going to either buy it or steal it. He's been a little vague about how he would get it. From whom he would get it is not at all clear. It doesn't belong to Israel. And he certainly has shown no indication that he's prepared to deal with Palestinians as people with agency, with land, with a nation of their own that he would have to deal with. None of that seems to be relevant. This is all about, I will take the land, I will get rid of this annoying population, and I will manage to get rid of the hundreds of thousands of tons of debris that was left over, and we will build this Middle East Riviera. You know, if you want to say that it's too badly destroyed for people to go back, there's certainly a logic to that. Then the answer is, yeah, and they have the right to return to their original homes. 80% of the population of Gaza are themselves refugees from before the 5 or 7 or 10 times that they were made refugees again and again and again internally in this last 16 months because of Israeli bombing. These are people who were expelled from their homes in what is now southern Israel in what the Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe of 1947-48, when 750,000 Palestinians were expelled from their homes, half of what has been expelled this time. The Nakba was always seen, called the catastrophe, because it was always imagined it could never be that bad again until October of 2023 when it began again. And the Nakba 2.0 has now made more than twice that refugees over and over and over again.
Well, Phyllis, what are any possible plans that have been discussed internationally for an alternative to Donald Trump's illegal and criminal plan to eliminate the Palestinian population from Gaza? Is there another neutral military or civil authority to somehow preside over reconstruction and rehabilitation of that devastated land at this point?
The possibility for governance, there was a conference in Beijing sponsored by China, of all the Palestinian factions, including Hamas, including Fatah and the political parties that are involved in the Palestinian Authority that has administrative control of small parts of the West Bank, where we should note is there's major escalation underway. But they made a decision there, the Palestinian parties, that there would be a joint government. Hamas made very clear they do not want to be part of the governance. They understand the problem with that. They are perfectly willing to have the other Palestinian parties collectively create a government to run Gaza. But all the questions remain of if people want to remain there, if rebuilding is the right thing to do, what would happen in the meantime? That's a years-long process. Where would they live in the meantime? Who would pay for the rebuilding? None of this is clear. None of this is clear. And the reality, I think, for many is Palestinians are still facing genocide. The ceasefire has been incredibly important to see the end of shelling, mostly. But they are still facing the consequences and the day-to-day reality of starvation, of lack of shelter, of lack of clean water. The hospitals are still not functioning. Genocide is still underway. And while that's true, all people can think about is, how am I going to feed my children tonight? What will I feed them tomorrow?
That was Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, international advisor for Jewish Voice for Peace, and author of the new book titled Understanding Palestine and Israel, published by Interlink Books. Find more analysis and commentary on Trump's illegal Gaza plan by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since Donald Trump's January 20th inauguration, billionaire Elon Musk and a team of young men between the ages of 19 and 24, most linked to Musk's companies, have engaged in an illegal coup, attempting to freeze the U.S. Treasury Department payment system, eliminate or degrade over a dozen federal agencies, and end government civil rights and diversity policies. One member of Musk's government wrecking crew, 25-year-old Marco Alez, who had posted racist comments on social media, including his call for a eugenic immigration policy, repeal of the Civil Rights Act, and urge Silicon Valley to normalize Indian hate, resigned. But Musk quickly rehired him. Musk, owner of companies including Tesla, SpaceX, and the social media platform X, formerly known as Twitter, donated over $288 million to Trump and Republican candidates in the 2024 campaign, and is now leading the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, with the self-declared mission of eliminating $2 trillion in government waste, fraud, and abuse. But in response to lawsuits brought by federal employees and Democratic state attorneys general, several federal judges have blocked Trump and Musk's attempt to bypass Congress and the U.S. Constitution to impose their autocratic plan to reshape government. In response to a judge's ruling, Musk and Vice President J.D. Vance have attacked the legitimacy of judicial oversight of Trump's executive authority, a fundamental pillar of American democracy, which is based on the Constitution's separation of powers. Your reporter spoke with Amanda Marcotte, a senior politics writer at Salon.com, who discusses her recent article titled, "Hitler Actually Had Some Decent Points, Musk's Covert Coup is Guided by Internet Trolls," which examines the illegal elimination of government agencies and the white supremacy that guides Musk's hacker army.
So what we do know is that Musk and this group of quote-unquote Doge employees are trying to get into the computer systems of the federal government. It's completely illegal. And Musk is going on Twitter and insisting over and over that he can unilaterally just cut entire federal bureaucracies. He's tried to destroy USAID. He's on Twitter claiming that he can just single-handedly end the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He can't do these things. It's illegal. It's only Congress can do those things. But Musk is operating under the theory that he basically is the unilateral power now. Congress is irrelevant, that they don't matter anymore. And to a large extent, that even Trump doesn't really matter anymore. So I can get into it, but we know kind of where he's getting these ideas and what kind of theory he's operating under. He went after USAID, it seems, because this guy he follows on Twitter, who's an avowed white nationalist, who's spoken openly of his admiration of Hitler, said to.
Speaking of Hitler and Nazis, Amanda, tell us a little bit about what we know of some of these six young men in particular who've been leading this coup d'etat, trying to eliminate many departments of government. There was a guy you wrote about called Edward Korstein. There's Marco Velez. And I wonder if you would just summarize for our audience a little bit about what their belief systems are and what they've posted on social media that should have all of us very alarmed.
A lot of the six young men don't have huge public profiles, so I don't want to like speak to that very much. But like Alez had a social media account that some journalists attached to him where he posted a lot of very racist things. He said, "You couldn't pay me to marry outside of my ethnicity." He openly self-identified as a racist. He said he hates Indian people and thinks they're stupid and will be replaced by LLMs. He kind of spoke about wanting mass deportations of legal immigrants. So that's where that guy is. And the fact that there's a bunch of racist trolls online is not surprising at this point. But I will say what was striking to me was that he resigned after he got outed for these posts. And then Musk very showingly went on Twitter and said he wants him back. And then Vice President J.D. Vance hopped in and said that he wants him back, too. So what this is really very importantly, not just about these young men, but about Elon Musk and J.D. Vance using this as an opportunity to basically say that they think that white supremacy, neo-Nazi views, et cetera, should not be a problem for somebody that wants to have control over the Treasury Department.
Do you think most of the American people are catching up with this story about the kinds of people that are involved in this Trump administration and the takeover of these federal agencies? Certainly people knew about Trump quoting Hitler and his other vile statements that he's made in his first term and during this recent campaign. So I guess they can't plead ignorance. Do you see what's going on here with Elon Musk reaching a pivot point of some kind where people will say, hey, we do have a constitution and Congress does matter. Those are our representatives, whatever party they voted for.
No, I don't think people are noticing yet. I think the vast majority of people do not follow the news very closely. They vaguely see these stories, but unfortunately, Elon Musk, computers, Treasury Department, Doge, all these words, government efficiency, those are all words that are meant to cause the average American to tune out and assume it's not an interesting story. I don't think that most people are able to grasp that this is a coup. I think that most people are just hearing, like, the Republicans are spinning that Musk is in there just trying to make the government more efficient and cut stuff. And, you know, once you start saying, well, he doesn't have the legal authority to do that, like, most people are like zoning out, tuning out, like looking at TikTok, do not care. Because unfortunately, that just sounds like boring government disputes about law. So unfortunately, I think right now most people aren't paying attention, and they definitely aren't paying close enough attention to notice all the Nazi stuff. And even if they do, all they get are denials. So they're like, well, the other guys say it's not Nazi, so I guess who can say?
That was Amanda Marcotte, a senior politics writer at Salon.com and author of Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters. Find links to her recent articles about the Trump-Musk coup by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On February 5th, people opposed to the Trump-Musk agenda, as outlined in the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, held protest rallies at every state capital across the U.S. Since taking office, Trump has issued dozens of executive orders revoking basic human and civil rights, attempted to freeze all government grants and loans, and enlisted his largest campaign contributor, tech billionaire Elon Musk, to direct illegal operations to eliminate entire federal agencies and fire hundreds of thousands of civil servants. The nationwide action called 5051 initially generated questions from some progressive political activists who didn't know the organizers or groups behind it and were hesitant to participate. But that didn't stop thousands of concerned individuals from coming out to protest actions in more than 80 cities and towns across America. In Connecticut, a 40-something single mom with a full-time job was the key organizer of the protest rally at the state capitol in Hartford, which drew hundreds of people to demonstrate with creative signs facing a major thoroughfare. Motorists drove by for at least 2 hours, with many of them honking their horns in support. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with that Connecticut organizer, Praisley McNamara, who said she was motivated to take action after Donald Trump's second inauguration on January 20th.
After the inauguration, I really started to feel overwhelmed with obviously the flood the zone plan that Project 2025 and even Steve Bannon, you know, has talked about multiple times, where so many things are changing, so many things are being dismantled, leaving so many questions in everyone's mind, right? I was feeling very panicked. I'm doing a lot of hand-wringing. What can I do? How can I release some of this nervous, like pent-up but motivated energy? So when I saw on Reddit that there was a 50501 hashtag, like basically a trending group, I looked it up immediately, and it was 50 protests across 50 states on one day. And I just want to say to begin this, I'm so excited and proud that that actually happened. So every single state had one at every single capital, sometimes multiple. My sister said to me, you should try Meetup. So I created a Meetup group and people started jumping in. Then I created the event. This was like January 30th, maybe 31st. 79 people checked off that they were going in a matter of 4 or 5 days. I started talking about making protest signs. I just said, you know, we'll figure out where to be when we get there. Right. I don't know a soul personally that was at that rally on Wednesday. But knowing that those are the people that believe in the democracy that I've been raised in for 40 years, that I believe, that I've studied, it felt really reassuring to have that intentional community.
The media is a big problem in all this. Some outlets on the left are calling this a coup in the making. Mainstream corporate media are covering what's happening, but not drawing any conclusions about what it means. And of course, the public media like NPR and PBS, which still get some federal funding, are in the crosshairs of losing all of it.
It's almost like the news is watching what's happening as a fishbowl or a terrarium, just kind of commenting on it, as opposed to using the fact that they're the media to take a stand and call to action. No media, Fox, ABC, NBC, CBS, no one is calling this what it is, right? If you look at the steps that were taken in the late 30s, early 40s, and you were to side by side it, like one of the gentlemen did at the rally with the huge poster, they're almost lockstep with Project 2025. Russell Vought was confirmed last night by every single Republican senator, including Susan Collins, including people that were moderate that we thought, okay, they're going to recognize the crisis status here and do the right thing. That's not the case. We are in this together.
That was a fantastic event. It was such a morale booster and, after feeling so negative about everything for so long, it was just great to be out in that crowd of people. But now what?
What is next, at least for Praisley, for me, is I need to urge people to look upward at the 1%. We've been taught to look left and right at each other, finger point, blame, degrade, judge, butt up against left and right. We've been taught that on purpose by the 1%, by the quote leaders, by the people in charge, because if we're fighting each other, we won't fight upwards. We have to find a unifying theme. I want people to try to rally across our whole 98 or 99% and start looking upward, because that's where the problem is.
That was Praisley McNamara, an organizer of the February 5th 50-51 anti-Trump protest in Hartford, Connecticut. Another nationwide 50-state anti-Trump protest is being organized on President's Day, February 17th. Learn more about the 50-51 movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WERU in Blue Hill, Maine, KTWH in Two Harbors, Minnesota, KODX in Seattle, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.